In a way, the seminar received a different kind of focus than I had in mind when I designed this as a course by the reality of students. What they needed was something different. So many of the students in the seminar realized that their experiences were shared by other students. And there was a lot of exchange about exactly these kinds of experiences. And people felt very sort of seen and were interested in sharing their own experience, were interested in hearing about other people's experiences. So we spent a lot of time on that level to talk about shared experience.
Welcome to this episode of the Unconditional Teaching podcast. Unconditional Teaching is a project by Jessica Koch, Till Zibura, and myself, Katharina Pietsch. Together, we write articles and record interviews in which we investigate how we can create healthier relationships in learning and teaching. In this episode, we talk about a blog seminar titled Owning Your Position, Critical Argumentation Skills for Scholars of Culture that Till taught in July 2020. The concept of the class was to give students tools to transfer their knowledge of critical theory into discussions they have in their everyday life. In this first part of our conversation, Till tells us a bit about the concept of the class, how he adapted it to meet the needs of the students in the online semester, and how he dealt with the teaching challenges of a Zoom classroom. We also talk about ways of communicating that facilitate trust between teachers and learners, and about the power of showing vulnerability.
You had a very tough blog seminar.
I did have a very tough blog seminar. It was tough and beautiful and gratifying, exhausting, but really cool.
Yeah. So
students were really cool.
Yeah, as they are. And what was the title of the seminar again?
The title of the seminar was Owning Your Position, Critical Argumentation Skills for Scholars of Culture. So, and the concept was to give students tools to transfer their knowledge of critical theory into discussions they have in their everyday life. Because in one of the last seminars that I taught, we had this conversation where students said, "Oh, I'm having these discussions about identity politics, about racism, about sexism, about the value of feminism, or things like that, with my relatives, with friends of mine. I'm having these discussions all the time, and it's really hard to make them understand what gender versus biological sex means, or how to use postcolonial theory, their knowledge of Said or Orientalism or othering in these kinds of discussions, because as used as we all are in discussing this on an academic level and in classrooms, this turns out to be a bubble when it comes to transferring our academic knowledge to everyday situations. So I thought it would be really cool, really useful to ask students what kinds of discussions they usually have, what kinds of conflicts they have with their friends, with their family, and to give them strategies of discussion that can help them use their academic knowledge. Not only friends and family, also, I mean, many of our students are part of a larger LGBTQ community. They are active in internet forums, on social media, in fan communities, and so on. And of course, these kinds of discussions are happen there in these contexts all the time. Yeah. So that was the concept of the seminar. It was a block seminar, 5 days, all day, basically. And my original planning, and that was pre-corona, was to have a lot of role-playing situations, practice strategies, a lot of discussions, then do research, read up on rhetoric, on toxic strategies, also the weapons that trolls use, for example. There's a lot of writing on that, which goes way beyond classical rhetoric, of course, that to identify the destructive strategies that people use on the internet, for example, to derail conversations or to argue in bad faith and so on. And we did some of that in the seminar, but of course, not everything was possible via Zoom, via online teaching.
That's what I wanted to ask, because I can't imagine how I would have tried to pull this off in the current situation with Corona happening and social distancing and not being able to sort of meet up in an actual room. Like, what was the battle plan there even?
There was no battle plan.
Yeah. There was just,
yeah, no. I was scared shitless. I've never been so anxious, and insecure about any seminar I've ever taught. And I told the students as much. I sort of, in the first session, I said, look, I haven't taught an online seminar all semester. This is the first seminar I'm teaching. And you have all the experience. I have basically none. I have no plan, and I have no idea how this is going to work. All I know is that I can't bear to be on Zoom for more than 1.5 hours. And things followed from that, basically. So one of the consequences was we have a morning session and we have an afternoon session. And in between, there's a lunch break, and I'll give some research task or something else. So, and the 1.5 hours, I split into two segments. And often we did like 2 hours with 15 minutes of break in between. And I tried to have these role-playing situations, but as I had envisioned it, more guided, in a more guided form, so that I could say, okay, this is how we're going to do this. We'll distribute roles. And one of you has to be the antagonist in the discussion, and one of you has to monitor the discussion, and several others can collaborate on coming up with strategies to argue against this antagonist. And the antagonist would take the statements that students sent in preparation for the seminar as a foil for their ideological position. And I mean, that was one of the crassest things about this entire thing. The things that students sent in, which they are confronted with in their everyday life, were really bad. I wouldn't have imagined that many of our students are confronted with just overt racism or really crass forms of sexism on a fairly regular basis. So they sent in statements that they hear within their circles, like looking at women and saying things like, well, if they get raped, they really can't complain. If you dress like that, you've called for it, basically. And I mean, this blows my mind that they actually witness things like this, which to me come from the dark ages of the 1980s and 90s, basically, but still it's a phenomenon today, obviously. Or the classical racist or anti-immigrant rhetoric of, well, they take our jobs, things that we've also heard for forever, and so on. So these were examples for the things that the antagonists in the role play situations would would say and defend, of course. And then we, with our critical theory, who normally is relatively speechless when confronted with stupidity or radical confrontational rhetoric like that, would have to find a way to argue against
it. Yeah, or simply with people who are misinformed or non-informed. I guess that plays a role as well. I mean, the rhetoric is the same, but sometimes it's a simple inverted commas matter of access to good information. And I struggle with that myself, to be a source of good information and to relay this information in a way that my interlocutor can digest, as it were, without feeling like I've attacked them personally for something that they are not aware of is in and of itself a destructive thought. But like with the overt examples of racism and sexism and the like, that's of course a completely different matter.
Yeah, and I mean, there were also statements like, to just give a couple of more examples, statements like, why is there's gay people all over TV all of a sudden? Why are they everywhere right now? Every TV show has to have some gay person or some queer person.
Nobody ever asked why there are so many white men all over TV, right? Nobody ever did ask about that.
Right, but now it's the white men who suddenly notice that there are people on TV who are different from them. And they notice this kind of difference and are kind of slightly bemused or even outraged, right? And of course, they sit on the same sofa with our students, like, right, just watching dinner TV. And so how do you tackle that without going into what representation means and Stuart Hall and sort of political history in the sense of liberationist gay movements or things like that?
What kind of strategies did you come up with?
Well, this was the difficult thing, I think. What I did on the first day was give a little input, and I wanted to make this as sort of accessible as possible so that we could talk about real life situations as soon as possible. And I assumed and had stated that as a participation prerequisite that everyone was familiar with critical theory of one kind or another and would be able to transfer their knowledge or have some knowledge to transfer them. So I gave some input on classical Aristotelian rhetoric as people teach it in American high school contexts. In Germany, that's just not a thing. Nobody does that here. You don't learn anything about rhetorical strategies or argumentation. So things like ethos-based or pathos-based or logos-based argumentation styles, right? So arguing from a moral standpoint, arguing from an emotional standpoint, arguing from personal experience, or arguing from a rational, logical standpoint. And we discussed a little how you come up with these arguments and how you identify them also, so as not to confuse the levels or be blindsided by someone whom you try to argue with on a logos-based level, as we are wont to do in academia, who suddenly only argues on the pathos-based level, on the emotional level. And what we did was try find examples for these kinds of situations. And then I also introduced them to, as I said, these tropes, toxic tropes, as I called them, like strawman arguments or like concern trolls. So people who argue in bad faith, the concept of the red herring, which is thrown into a conversation to derail it, basically, to so that the original objective is lost out of sight, and so on.
What is a concern troll?
consent.
I mean, I can sort of infer from the two concepts what it may be, but I've never heard it in combination.
A concern troll is someone who pretends to argue in good faith. Someone who says, "Oh yeah, I think I'm also a feminist. I think I agree with you, but," and then comes a long string of sort of well-meant concerns. Right? Isn't it counterproductive if you use a rhetoric as a feminist that is so radical as the rhetoric that you use, right? Shouldn't you be more balanced in your way of argumentation, right? Is it really helpful to do this and that? Is it, so with the Black Lives Matter thing, a concern troll would argue like, oh yeah, I do get that Black Lives Matter, but with all the rioting, it's really hard to support the movement. So pretending, instead of saying outright, dude, this is unacceptable and I won't talk to anyone who condones protesting that turns into rioting, right? This would be sort of the direct argument, and sort of people would argue in good faith that you can disagree with them on and find sort of a ground for conversation. But the concern troll evades that. They always say, yes, yes, okay, I understand, but,
yeah,
and bring in new concerns.
Is that just so I understand correctly, is it like, this is something that I've come across, people saying, yes, of course I'm for equality, but don't you think that feminism has gone too far, or is going too, yes, far at the moment? Is this the same sort of mechanism?
Then? That's the same thing. Yes, absolutely.
Oh dear.
Also with this very same formulation, but don't you think?
Yeah. Okay.
Right? I'm all for X, but don't you think that? That's basically the rhetorical formula of a concern troll. And some concern trolls are malevolent, so they know what they're doing, and some concern trolls are just ignorant. They mean well, but they don't know that their discussion strategy or their strategy is not really helpful. Yeah, and we try to have these role play situations, but that worked reasonably well in Zoom, where you can have these breakout rooms. People really like breakout rooms. But not sitting in the same room, not being able to take social cues very well, made it really hard to get into the role. And I think some of the discussions stayed on a meta level, where people discussed, okay, what would I say now? And what would you say now? And how would we reply to this? Instead of going in character, basically. Mm. Which is always a difficult thing. And of course, once you have these breakout rooms, I can only jump into one breakout room at a time. And I felt very uncomfortable with the whole technology, really, even though that got better halfway through. But at the beginning, that was really difficult. So you asked what kind of strategies did you come up with? And it's hard to say, because it's hard to say for me, because the groups did a lot of the work, and not always did we have time to get this back into the plenary. But from what I heard, people found this helpful, even if we weren't able to come up with a catalogue then of good strategies.
So basically it's a sort of training ground, really, for getting some exercise in when it comes to talking to people who may not be equally informed about, as you said, representation, for instance, and post-structuralist analysis.
Yeah. I think it turned out in a way the seminar received a different kind of focus than I had in mind when I designed this as a course, by the reality of students. What they needed was something different. And this had to do with an online semester. It had to do with the fact that many of the students recognized for the first time that these conflicts they are engaged in their private lives, where they feel the need to have the terminology that they are so used to from university. So many of the students in the seminar realized that their experiences were shared by other students. And there was a lot of exchange about exactly these kinds of experiences. And people felt very sort of seen and were interested in sharing their own experience, were interested in hearing about other people's experiences. So we spent a lot of time on that level to talk about shared experience. And this was really nice. And I was completely on board in doing that and spending more time on that than I would have imagined before, because after this online distance teaching semester, many students were needy of exchange and conversation and communication. That was the most remarkable thing, really. I was extremely anxious beforehand that this would be sort of distanced and impersonal, although I knew many of the students, and I knew if half of them show up in a good mood and ready to share, this would be a really cool seminar. But I was still anxious about this lack of immediate contact, of not being able to read facial expressions very well, of having bad sound quality all the time, all the things that tire me out on Zoom to no end, really. And that sort of multiplied to 25, because that was the number of participants in the seminar. I wouldn't have imagined that this worked so well as it did.
Yeah. I think one of the things that may be part of why it's so hard to stay in Zoom longer for me, it's like the 90-minute, 2-hour break. That's when I realize that, and it's too much usually, is that you see so many different faces in different resolutions, in different distances, and it's so exhausting to have these different sort of face sizes and, I don't know, different textures depending on how good the webcams are, and then the voice quality is different, and you don't know whether your voice carries the same way as it would in a classroom. And yeah. And I mean, you too. I mean, I know how you're teaching when you're live in a classroom, and we are both like movers. We move a lot. We move up and down. We use hands. We, you know, we don't sit and read from a book, but we like to move around a lot. And this is, of course, not possible in the same way when you're in front of a PC.
Totally. One of the hardest things was that I didn't have a blackboard. Mm. I take a lot of notes. I create mind maps from student input and sort of my own thoughts, and I connect things, and sometimes it gets messy, but feedback tells me that this is really useful just to protocol the train of thought of the entire class. My teaching style is conversation-based, discourse-based. I talk to students, I ask them what they think, I listen, I take this up, I synthesize a lot, I reframe student input in more theoretical academic language if I think that is necessary, and I take a lot of notes on the blackboard while I'm doing this. And this is sort of, this kind of multitasking is my bread and butter skill, basically. I'm really, really good at that, I think. But on Zoom, I was like as if someone had switched me off, basically. I could only do one thing, and then there was the chat, which I had to look out for, and people raising their hands. I figured out how that works, but that wasn't quite enough. So we had a second system of people using another of these reaction bubbles for when they wanted to jump in immediately. And I, as the lecturer, had to have my eye on that constantly. And there was no way of taking notes for me at the same time, seeing the faces and so on. I found that exhausting, like you can't imagine.
I mean, it doesn't work with, I mean, you could argue that, okay, then give the protocoling to a student, but that's not the same thing because we...
I'm not just protocoling.
Yeah, exactly. And I think it's a way of working on our own thoughts. If I don't have that, I find it more difficult to track my own thoughts. So having, and sort of the spatial depth, as it were, that comes with working with a blackboard, turning around and then being back in a class. That's, I mean, there are functions in online teaching, like programs that give you like a virtual blackboard, but it's simply not yeah. the same.
No.
And then you have all these other tasks that you need to manage while in a Zoom classroom that don't happen in a regular classroom. And it's just, I get it's more exhausting.
I have no doubt that with more experience, with more practice, you can become more proficient in these kinds of multitasking. But if I use a notebook app or a Blackboard app at the same time as I use Zoom, I can't see any faces. I have to sort of click to make two clicks to go get back into the classroom, as opposed to just turning my head around. All this kinds of interaction with tiny buttons and sort of pointing around with my mouse, or worse even with the pad on a laptop and so on, makes this so much harder and less intuitive. We found a fairly good compromise at the end of the seminar on the second to last day, where someone suggested, hey, can't we make an open document? So we used a Google Doc where everyone had access to sort of without, completely free, right? Without having to sign in into an account or whatever. Everyone who had the link could edit the document, and people were sharing their notes from previous days. And I made a couple of comments after class, provided some links and some additional information on stuff. And that was fairly cool, actually. I think people like to have this track record of what the seminar was about, and we structured that collectively in terms of the days that we had, and people posted stuff that was relevant to the seminar, and it's more durable than the chat, obviously. And it was a collective thing, and that was a great idea. I wish I had that from day one, and for my next seminars I will make that available from the beginning, yes.
But I think like this, I mean, I think this is a super cool development because it says so much about the way this class worked. Because, okay, so the whole corona situation, I thought, makes it abundantly clear that classes only work when there's trust between lecturers and students, because the social contract is different. It's broken in some places because there is not the same sort of requirements, for instance, being present or something like that, attached to this. So it requires us to reformulate a type of social contract in the classroom. And your students apparently participated extremely actively in reforging a social contract that was beneficial to their academic growth, even very late in the seminar. I think this is really, really cool. And it just goes to show that they had a deep interest in the content and an interest in making this class a success. So these were not people looking for input in that sense, but rather for exchange, for discourse. And I think that's really, really cool. When somebody so late in a class makes a suggestion, everybody says, yeah, let's do this together. That sounds great.
Yeah, absolutely. And that it was like this from the very beginning. I mean, as soon as I said, even before the seminar started, I sent around an email and invited people to a prep session, a voluntary prep session, where I wanted to ask them, what are the things about digital teaching that you like? Which are the strategies that I could adopt to make the seminar a success? And there were surprising, even though this was completely voluntary, sort of an extra thing, there were a surprising number of people present, And they were so extremely helpful. As soon as I said, look, I'm really anxious about this. I have no clue really how to do that. And I'm trying to rely on your experience with successful parts of digital teaching to make the seminar better for every one of us. They gave me links. They gave me advice. They also gave me a lot of support, just a lot of emotional support. They said, Till, don't worry about this. If you need help with the technology, we know we have this figured out by now. And you can always ask us. Don't worry too much. It's going to be fine. And there's this program that we can use if something doesn't work. And hey, I'll show you this other platform on Discord. Maybe you like that better. And then we can switch to whichever medium is better and so on. And I tried this out, and sort of people really were invested in taking me by the hand a little and saying, hey, this is not as hard as you fear it is, and we'll figure it out together. That was so nice right from the start. And then during the seminar, there was this constant support of people saying, oh, this worked well, let's do this again. Giving feedback about what they wanted from the seminar, what they liked about the seminar. And I ran with it, really. I had thrown many of my plans out of the window anyway, and I was really happy to just listen and let them tell me what they would like. And also, after day one, I was a bit more relaxed myself and could accept that not everything that was could ever work as I wanted it to work, and I was okay with it.
Teaching is an exchange. I mean, that's a very cool example of that. I mean, you tell them, or they tell you, look, Till, this is not as terrible as you think it is right now. It's gonna be okay. It can actually work. And you telling them, look, arguing with concern trolls is not as hard or not as terrible as you think. This can work. And then you have this mutual learning experience on completely different levels. But still, I mean, both parties are growing in that process in all kinds of directions. And I mean, particularly with online teaching, this is a big thing. This is not just something that each and every one of us lecturers at universities or teachers in schools can just like do because we were born with a natural skill to use any type of medium. But it requires so much work and is connected to so much anxiety, and that students are able to say, hey, no problem, we're going to do this together. And this is, you're the host, and we are the guests, and the party only works when we sort of work together to make it fun and to make it work. I really like that.
Yeah. And I mean, there was even a situation on Wednesday. So the seminar went from Monday to Friday. And on Tuesday afternoon, I was extremely exhausted. Like, I mean, all evening, I was just done. And I knew I was in a state where and no matter how much sleep I would get, I wouldn't recover from the exhaustion, really. And so Wednesday, I tried to keep it together and to get through this as nicely as I could. And during the lunch break, I think I slept for half an hour. I felt more like I passed out, basically. And then we had the afternoon slot, and during the afternoon slot, we had another break, and I noticed I just can't, I don't know how I'm gonna do this. I don't know how I'm gonna survive this next hour. And I got back onto Zoom after the break, and I think I had sort of slept again for 5 minutes or something. And I was late, and everyone was already there, and I sort of stuttered for a bit. And then one of my students asked, Till, are you okay? Is everything okay? And just by him asking me, was I able to realize, no, I wasn't okay, and this wasn't gonna work. And if he hadn't asked, I would have just tried to barrel through and sort of do myself harm and bring nothing to the table for them, probably. So I said, yeah, no, I'm not okay. Thanks for asking. And I think I have to leave. I have to hand this over to you. And I made two of them host and left the session, basically. And that was perfectly fine. They did another hour of their own class, basically, and knew exactly what to do. And the next morning, I asked Leah, in this case, to host another block of the session so I could sit back a little and watch what they did, what they had done, their recap of the last day. And that, to me, that was a really caring and warm and very nice feeling to be seen, to be able to say, I'm not okay, I can't do this right now. And to be able to completely trust my students to have my back and to have their own back also, because they wouldn't have thought of quitting then and there, even though I said, look, if you don't know what to do, just quit and we see each other tomorrow. But they didn't do that. They took it in their own hands and did cool stuff, which they then told me about the next day.
Talking about showing vulnerability and how powerful that is. I'm also reminded, just as a very quick anecdote, I had a very similar situation when I had a few semesters back when I had an anxiety attack, a panic attack in class while I was teaching in a lecture hall. And I don't know what brought it on, really. It just happened and I realized I couldn't go on talking because I was hyperventilating. And I let them know, look, I'm having a panic attack. I have to sit down for a second and breathe. Can you go on with the discussion? And it took them about, I think, 5.5 seconds where they just looked at each other. She said that. Yeah, she said that. Okay. And then they went on with the discussion. It was no problem. And I took my five to 10 minutes to get my breathing back under control. And then I said, okay, I'm back, guys. All is well. And everything was fine. It all was well. This place of vulnerability from the teacher strengthened the relationship between teachers and students if the whole class is built on trust. And I think this something very, very similar, maybe even the same happened in that instance. I think that's so cool.
Speaking of relationship, I mean, this is one of the examples also, I think, where the students you had in this class sound like very, very different people than the students that many other lecturers had in their Zoom classes during the semester, where people, I don't know, didn't turn their cameras on, or these are only some of the things that I've heard lecturers complain about, that they didn't even care to like answer questions, even questions like what do you want, how do you want this to go, or do you have any questions to ask me, and so on. And they complained about there usually being complete silence, and sometimes they were like lecturing to a set of black tiles, basically, and so on. So this also, especially compared to the things that I've heard other people talk about and complain about, Zoom classes sound so absolutely different.
I mean, I've also heard that. I'm not convinced that these were completely different students, but I can sort of, from the feedback that I've received and from the exchanges that we had during the seminar, students also said, this seminar is completely different from all the other seminars that I had this semester. So they, of course, have the same experience with sort of sitting in classes where no one turns on their camera. And they also talked a lot about how bad these experiences were from their end for them. Right. And having teachers sort of become aggressive when they see these black tiles. And this is not conducive to anyone turning on their cameras, of course. Or so being afraid to be the only one to turn on the camera, even if they wanted to. Because then you're doubly exposed. You can be sure that everyone is looking at you because you're the only one who has their camera turned on. People said they had a lot of seminars where lecturers were completely absent all the time. So it was asynchronous all the way. So just uploading slides or talks and then giving exercises, and they turn in the exercises, which means they don't have contact to the lecturer, but also don't have contact to any other students. Or they reported seminars or seminar experiences where they had one presentation via Zoom after the other. So no exchange, no contact. Again, just the exposure of being the person at one point that has to give a presentation. Or they said they had seminars where the lecturer was talking all the time. So giving proper lectures via Zoom for 2 hours. And again, no contact, no communication, no exchange. Some said these breakout rooms on Zoom had been used by other lecturers and they really liked that. They also said in my seminar that one of the things they liked best were these frequent breakout rooms, because then they were actually in a place to talk to other students, camera or not, that doesn't matter at that point anymore. And speak and just hear other people talk. I think this human connection that is so lost during times of self-isolation is so important then for us to take up as lecturers and give people the opportunity to get in touch with each other, get in touch with us. And so that's what a lot of students said made the seminar special for them, because there was a lot of communication, a lot of exchange, because I can't do it otherwise. That's sort of, I can't teach in any other way, really. And we spent a lot of time on that. Yeah. So, of course, it helped that I knew a lot of the students. A lot of the students were people who were in my seminars before. A lot of students know how I do things. They know how I communicate. They feel comfortable in my seminars. And with me, they know each other from my seminars or from other contexts. And, of course, that helped. But all of these students have sat in all of these other seminars too, brought their experience to mine.
I think there are several things I think that are in these experiences from lecturers and students alike. One being that, yes, of course, a large number of students that comes to our seminars or that attends our seminars also go to other seminars also in other subjects and make totally different experiences there with the same sort of didactic tool or the same type of medium. For instance, I heard from a lot of students that they really enjoyed the breakout rooms, and that was exactly as you said, like a way to communicate with other students and to actually have conversation, discussion, debate, and just like a bit of human contact with people you don't live with. But on the other hand, just as many students let me know that the breakout rooms were an absolute catastrophe, that they were the only ones with a camera on while everybody else was not there and not even switching their microphone on, like talking into the void, really, and not getting anything back. Or other students, like some of our students complained that there are a small handful of trolls, really, who use their technological savviness to mess with the lecturer, manipulating, for instance, some sort of digital whiteboard, as it were. And I thought the larger the seminar or the lecture, the greater are the chances that there are one or two people who have the power to make the experience less enjoyable or even horrible for everybody. And sometimes this person is the lecturer, him or herself. And sometimes it's students who are not interested for whatever reason to become part of or to take responsibility for their own participation in a class. Like, and one of our students, Annalena, always asks for, like, where's the responsibility of the students? What, you know, you can do a lot as lecturers because you are in a relatively powerful position. However, students have to do their fair share of work too. And I totally see that. And then I think one of the reasons why I think your class may have worked out so well is because the very topic that you chose is targeted towards students who already have a vested interest in discussion and exchange. I don't think this type of topic draws in students who do not like to speak in class or ever, maybe, in any type of academic setting. So I think that's important to know, because then for certain topics we can make informed decisions as lecturers beforehand, basically shaping the topic and the things we want to discuss in a certain way in order to attract students who will benefit from this type of teaching. And it also means the other way around, that I need to be aware that when I'm teaching certain seminars that are just too huge to be practically manageable on Zoom, for instance, to remember that we need to be kind to ourselves and to our students, because this is not the most ideal situation for either of us.
Mm. Yeah. I did have a couple of participants who never participated in plenary discussions. I think they did participate in breakout room discussions, but who I never saw because they didn't switch their cameras on, or one didn't even have a camera. And that was completely fine. There were so many people who were eager to speak, eager to discuss. And from these few, I also know that they are active participants even if they don't participate, basically. They are active listeners. They take away a lot from the seminar. And at the end, for a block seminar, 25 people who were present every single day, to me is a success. I was really happy with the participation and the patience and the input from students. That was, for me, that was the best possible digital teaching experience that I could have had for a first seminar. Yeah.
But all that also, I mean, I think we can't mention this often enough, that you really, as a lecturer, you have a lot of means and a lot of power to design your class in a way, to address your students in a way, to like present yourself, to engage, and all that in order to like influence, not like actually causally shape, but more like influence or facilitate what students do in your class, how they behave, how they from their end shape the relationship to you. So you can't really, I don't think you can control it, but I think you can facilitate it and do a lot of things to at least allow for this kind of very benevolent and responsible and kind teacher-learner or teaching and learning relationships to happen in your class. And I mean, we talked about this before, but showing vulnerability, I think, is one of the most important, most just powerful means to do that. And it's so, I think it's sad that so many lecturers never make the experience how really kind and empathetic students can be once you level out the hierarchies that you usually have, just by making yourself vulnerable, but also by addressing their expertise, as you did with the technical stuff. Like genuinely saying, okay, I'm not the expert here, you are, and I'm relying on your expertise, and please help me. All these things, they are both very clear signals that you're willing to engage with them, not as people who are beneath you in a hierarchy at this moment, but as people who are either like emotionally just human beings in this situation as you are, or who are even experts on certain stuff. And you are also, because, I mean, we were talking about trust, and you signal very clearly that you are taking their advice and taking their expertise seriously. So it's actually, it's for them, it is worth investing in that. And because they, I think they know and they trust you that what they give you is actually worth something to you.
I think so. I mean, this is the kind of communication style that I try to foster and try to practice from the get-go, not shaming students for the needs and difficulties they have, but seeing them as people who have needs and difficulties like I have. So to me, at the beginning, it was inconceivable to have a seminar of people who don't show their faces. That was one of my biggest sort of fears, basically. And I even had this knee-jerked reaction of thinking about how do I make sure that everyone has their cameras on? And then, of course, it becomes, at some point, it became obvious that this is not what you do. This is not what I want to do. People leave their cameras off for reasons. They have good reasons, fair reasons, and my job is to respect that. But I can tell them about my own need for connection, for seeing the people who I talk to, which is legitimate. But I can only make them empathize with my need and ask them to make a step toward me. And if they choose to do so, my job is to be fucking grateful. And if they choose not to do so, then my job is to fucking accept their decision not to show their faces and not gripe about it, not comment on it anymore. Simply accept it. And for some people, it's a day-to-day thing. For some people, it's a general thing. And that's basically what I did. I said, look, I'd really appreciate it if we could switch all, if we could switch our cameras on. But if you, for some reason, can't do that for technical issues or for any other issues, I'm completely willing to accept that and I would comment on it. And in the prep session, for example, the preparatory meeting, a lot of people had their cameras switched off when they came in. And then I said exactly this, like, could we do this? Would you mind? And then a lot of people switched their cameras on immediately and were completely fine. And other people stayed little black tiles, and that was fine too. So just showing respect for their decision and showing that you assume that they know best what's good for them, basically. Seems like a simple thing, but sort of communicating this to others, respecting their choices, is then the way you also get more of what you yourself need.
Yeah, I had a very similar experience in my blog seminar in February in regard to the attendance question. And I told them, well, it's obvious that this class only works if you are here. It's called a writer's room. And the whole idea of the class is that we are here and that we write together. Okay. But if you can't attend for certain periods of time and whatever the reason, you don't have to apologize. You don't have to ask for my permission. I just assume that you have good reasons for your absence. And that's it. You have your reasons and you'll not be here for the time. And then you'll come back and everything's okay. And I think just signaling and telling them very, very clearly, of course I expect everyone to be here, but also not just for general reasons, but because this is how the whole class worked. And then also telling them, if you are not here, I assume that you have good reasons for that. I think this basically led to the fact that there were barely any absences at all. And the ones that were there, they had very, very good reasons, like because they still told me, but I made clear that it's not about, you're not asking about my permission, and it's not about giving you permission. It's just, it's okay that you are telling me, but you don't have to. And these were like people who had to work, who couldn't reschedule their work, or one person had a family funeral to attend and stuff like that. But everyone was basically there all the time. Sometimes they had an exam in the morning or something. So I also felt that this was the same kind of communication, and it led to people also wanting to be there because they didn't think they were forced by it,
yeah,
by the measures that I in the more powerful position had to force them to do something.
Yeah. Once you stop making them feel bad about being absent, the will to be present,
yeah,
is much greater, yeah, and the relaxation about the things that can't be helped when they need to be absent for reasons of work or personal reasons also helps them to like being there when they can.
Yeah, it's like, it's this one of the most mind-blowing things about relationships. I think you can only really say yes to something if you have the genuine, real right to say no to something.
Yeah, nice.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. I think this is always linked to radical acceptance and sort of stuff that I have from therapy that I can apply in teaching. But I think I think with you, Till, because I've seen how you teach, I came to realize that you're particularly good at, remarkably good at, really, at one thing that I find very admirable, and that is not just accepting that you yourself are vulnerable in certain situations, and then being wise enough, really, to share this vulnerability because it's important for your own mental, physical, emotional well-being at that moment, and that includes moments of teaching, but also to then in turn accept vulnerability from your students. Because I think the first step to accept one's own vulnerability in a position of power, to say, I need a 5-minute break right now and get myself a coffee, for instance, or I need to sit down right now, or can you go on leading the discussion because I'm drawing a blank, something like that. That I think this is easier from a institutional point of view. We are being put in situations where we can technically do such a thing. But then to accept that the people we are teaching, the students who come to our seminars, also are vulnerable and may be experiencing moments of extreme stress, extreme vulnerability in our very classrooms, maybe because of our classroom, but most likely because of things that have nothing to do with university but still have an impact on their academic career. I think that is much, much harder to do, or is sometimes simply forgotten. We just assume that people will let us know when they need something. But that's not, of course, not the case in the hierarchies that we live in. I think you are exceptional, and I've seen it happen in some of your classes that I attended, where it's clear to everybody in the room that they can trust you with their own vulnerability, and that you will trust them with your vulnerability. And that creates this, I think effects, for instance, like people come to class, people do prepare. And if they don't prepare, they are not ashamed because they know they had good reasons for not reading the text. And then they will say in class, look, sorry, I wasn't able to read the text. I'm going to skim and scan it right now, and then I'll be with you in 5 minutes. And your response is, sure, okay. And I think that's a skill that takes practice, and it takes the learning that empathy, as both of you have told me in the past, is something that needs to be practiced, not just thought about in theory. And I like that very, very much.
Thank you. Yeah, I feel very seen. It's nice.
You are very seen. I hope. I think I can see you both very clearly in cool work that you're doing.
Thanks for listening. This is the end of the first part of our conversation about Till's block seminar. In the second part, Till talks in more depth about the strategies of argumentation and discussion that he and his students had worked on in the seminar. Unconditional Teaching is a project by Till Zibura, Jessica Koch, and me, Katharina Peach. Music by Lily Olason. If you want to know more about our project and our partners, check out unconditional-teaching.com. Do you like our content or would like to engage with us? Head over to our comment sections or contact us via team@unconditional-teaching.com.